The £2 that B had given me lasted about 10 days. That it lasted so long was due to Paddy, who had learnt parsimony on the road, and considered even one sound meal a day a wild extravagance. Food, to him, had come to mean simply bread and margarine, the eternal tea and two slices, which will cheat hunger for an hour or two. He taught me how to live, food, bed, tobacco, and all, at the rate of half a crown a day. And he managed to earn a few extra shillings by glimming in the evenings. It was a precarious job because illegal, but it brought in a little and eked out our money. One morning we tried for a job as sandwich men. We went at 5 to an alleyway behind some offices, but there was already a queue of 30 or 40 men waiting, and after 2 hours we were told that there was no work for us. We had not missed much, for sandwich men have an unenviable job. They are paid about 3 shillings a day for 10 hours' work. It is hard work, especially in windy weather, and there is no skulking, for an inspector comes round frequently to see that the men are on their beats. To add to their troubles, they are only engaged by the day, or sometimes for 3 days, never weekly, so that they have to wait hours for their job every morning. The number of unemployed men who are ready to do the work makes them powerless to fight for better treatment. The job all sandwich men covet is distributing handbills, which is paid for at the same rate. When you see a man distributing handbills, you can do him a good turn by taking one, for he goes off duty when he has distributed all his bills. Meanwhile, we went on with the lodging-house life, a squalid, eventless life of crushing boredom. For days together there was nothing to do but sit in the underground kitchen, reading yesterday's newspaper, or when one could get hold of it, a back number of the Union Jack. It rained a great deal at this time, and everyone who came in steamed, so that the kitchen stank horribly. One's only excitement was the periodical tea and two slices. I do not know how many men are living this life in London. It must be thousands at the least. As to Paddy, it was actually the best life he had known for 2 years past. His interludes from tramping, the times when he had somehow laid hands on a few shillings, had all been like this. The tramping itself had been slightly worse. Listening to his whimpering voice, he was always whimpering when he was not eating, one realized what torture unemployment must be to him. People are wrong when they think that an unemployed man only worries about losing his wages. On the contrary, an illiterate man, with the work habit in his bones, needs work even more than he needs money. An educated man can put up with enforced idleness, which is one of the worst evils of poverty, but a man like Paddy, with no means of filling up time, is as miserable out of work as a dog on the chain. That is why it is such nonsense to pretend that those who have come down in the world are to be pitied above all others. The man who really merits pity is the man who has been down from the start, and faces poverty with a blank, resourceless mind. It was a dull time, and little of it stays in my mind except for talks with Bozo. Once the lodging house was invaded by a slumming party. Paddy and I had been out, and coming back in the afternoon we heard sounds of music downstairs. We went down to find 3 gentle people, sleekly dressed, holding a religious service in our kitchen. They were a grave and reverend seigneur in a frock coat, a lady sitting at a portable harmonium, and a chinless youth toying with a crucifix. It appeared that they had marched in and started to hold the service without any kind of invitation whatever. It was a pleasure to see how the lodgers met this intrusion. They did not offer the smallest rudeness to the slummers, they just ignored them. By common consent, everyone in the kitchen, 100 men perhaps, behaved as though the slummers had not existed. There they stood, patiently singing and exhorting, and no more notice was taken of them than if they had been earwigs. The gentleman in the frock coat preached a sermon, but not a word of it was audible. It was drowned in the usual din of songs, oaths, and the clattering of pans. Men sat at their meals and card games 3 feet away from the harmonium, peaceably ignoring it. Presently the slummers gave it up and cleared out, not insulted in any way, but merely disregarded. No doubt they consoled themselves by thinking how brave they had been, freely venturing into the lowest dens, etc., etc. Bozo said that these people came to the lodging house several times a month. They had influence with the police, and the deputy could not exclude them. It is curious how people take it for granted that they have a right to preach at you and pray over you as soon as your income falls below a certain level. After 9 days, B's £2 was reduced to 1 and 9 pence. Paddy and I set aside 18 pence for our beds and spent 3 pence on the usual tea and 2 slices, which we shared, an appetizer rather than a meal. By the afternoon, we were damnably hungry, and Paddy remembered a church near King's Cross Station where a free tea was given once a week to tramps. This was the day, and we decided to go there. Bozo, though it was rainy weather, and he was almost penniless, would not come, saying that churches were not his style. Outside the church, quite 100 men were waiting, dirty types who had gathered from far and wide at the news of a free tea, like kites round a dead buffalo. Presently the doors opened, and a clergyman and some girls shepherded us into a gallery at the top of the church. It was an evangelical church, gaunt and wilfully ugly, with texts about blood and fire blazoned on the walls, and a hymn book containing 1,251 hymns. Reading some of the hymns, I concluded that the book would do as it stood for an anthology of bad verse. There was to be a service after the tea, and the regular congregation were sitting in the well of the church below. It was a weekday, and there were only a few dozen of them, mostly stringy old women who reminded one of boiling fowls. We ranged ourselves in the gallery pews and were given our tea. It was a 1 pound jam jar of tea each, with 6 slices of bread and margarine. As soon as tea was over, a dozen tramps who had stationed themselves near the door bolted to avoid the service. The rest stayed, less from gratitude than lacking the cheek to go. The organ let out a few preliminary hoots, and the service began. And instantly, as though at a signal, the tramps began to misbehave in the most outrageous way. One would not have thought such scenes possible in a church. All round the gallery, men lolled in their pews, laughed, chatted, leaned over, and flicked pellets of bread among the congregation. I had to restrain the man next to me, more or less by force, from lighting a cigarette. The tramps treated the service as a purely comic spectacle. It was indeed a sufficiently ludicrous service, the kind where there are sudden yells of hallelujah and endless extempore prayers. But their behaviour passed all bounds. There was one old fellow in the congregation, Brother Bootle, or some such name, who was often called on to lead us in prayer, and whenever he stood up, the tramps would begin stamping as though in a theatre. They said that on a previous occasion he had kept up an extempore prayer for 25 minutes until the minister had interrupted him. Once, when Brother Bootle stood up, a tramp called out, 2 to 1, he don't beat 7 minutes, so loud that the whole church must hear. It was not long before we were making far more noise than the minister. Sometimes somebody below would send up an indignant hush, but it made no impression. We had set ourselves to guy the service, and there was no stopping us. It was a queer, rather disgusting scene. Below were the handful of simple, well-meaning people trying hard to worship, and above were the 100 men whom they had fed, deliberately making worship impossible. A ring of dirty, hairy faces grinned down from the gallery, openly jeering. What could a few women and old men do against 100 hostile tramps? They were afraid of us, and we were frankly bullying them. It was our revenge upon them for having humiliated us by feeding us. The minister was a brave man. He thundered steadily through a long sermon on Joshua, and managed almost to ignore the sniggers and chattering from above. But in the end, perhaps goaded beyond endurance, he announced loudly, "I shall address the last 5 minutes of my sermon to the unsaved sinners." Having said which, he turned his face to the gallery and kept it so for 5 minutes, lest there should be any doubt about who were saved and who unsaved. But much we cared. Even while the minister was threatening hell fire, we were rolling cigarettes, and at the last amen, we clattered down the stairs with a yell, many agreeing to come back for another free tea next week. The scene had interested me. It was so different from the ordinary demeanour of tramps, from the abject worm-like gratitude with which they normally accept charity. The explanation, of course, was that we outnumbered the congregation, and so were not afraid of them. A man receiving charity practically always hates his benefactor. It is a fixed characteristic of human nature, and when he has 50 or 100 others to back him, he will show it. In the evening, after the free tea, Paddy unexpectedly earned another 18 pence at Glimming. It was exactly enough for another night's lodging, and we put it aside and went hungry till 9 the next evening. Bozo, who might have given us some food, was away all day. The pavements were wet, and he had gone to the Elephant and Castle, where he knew of a pitch under shelter. Luckily, I still had some tobacco, so that the day might have been worse. At 8:30, Paddy took me to the embankment, where a clergyman was known to distribute meal tickets once a week. Under Charing Cross Bridge, 50 men were waiting, mirrored in the shivering puddles. Some of them were truly appalling specimens. They were embankment sleepers, and the embankment dredges up worse types than the spike. One of them, I remember, was dressed in an overcoat without buttons, laced up with rope, a pair of ragged trousers, and boots exposing his toes, not a rag else. He was bearded like a fakir, and he had managed to streak his chest and shoulders with some horrible black filth resembling train oil. What one could see of his face under the dirt and hair was bleached white as paper by some malignant disease. I heard him speak, and he had a goodish accent, as of a clerk or shopwalker. Presently the clergyman appeared, and the men ranged themselves in a queue in the order in which they had arrived. The clergyman was a nice, chubby, youngish man, and curiously enough very like Charlie, my friend in Paris. He was shy and embarrassed, and did not speak except for a brief good evening. He simply hurried down the line of men, thrusting a ticket upon each, and not waiting to be thanked. The consequence was that, for once, there was genuine gratitude, and everyone said that the clergyman was a good fella. Someone, in his hearing, I believe, called out, "Well, he'll never be a fucking bishop!" This, of course, intended as a warm compliment. The tickets were worth 6 pence each, and were directed to an eating-house not far away. When we got there, we found that the proprietor, knowing that the tramps could not go elsewhere, was cheating by only giving 4 pennyworth of food for each ticket. Paddy and I pooled our tickets and received food which we could have got for 7 pence or 8 pence at most coffee shops. The clergyman had distributed well over £1 in tickets, so that the proprietor was evidently swindling the tramps to the tune of 7 shillings or more a week. This kind of victimization is a regular part of a tramp's life, and it will go on as long as people continue to give meal tickets instead of money. Paddy and I went back to the lodging house, and still hungry, loafed in the kitchen, making the warmth of the fire a substitute for food. At 10:30, Bozo arrived, tired out and haggard, for his mangled leg made walking an agony. He'd not earned a penny at screeving, all the pitchers under shelter being taken, and for several hours he had begged outright with one eye on the policeman. He had amassed 8 pence, a penny short of his kip. It was long past the hour for paying, and he had only managed to slip indoors when the deputy was not looking. At any moment he might be caught and turned out to sleep on the embankment. Bozo took the things out of his pockets and looked them over, debating what to sell. He decided on his razor, took it round the kitchen, and in a few minutes he'd sold it for 3 pence, enough to pay his kip, buy a basin of tea, and leave a halfpenny over. Bozo got his basin of tea and sat down by the fire to dry his clothes. As he drank the tea, I saw that he was laughing to himself, as though at some good joke, surprised. I asked him what he had to laugh at. "He's bloody funny," he said. "He's funny enough for Punch.
What do you think I've been and done? What? Sold my razor without having a shave first. Of all the fools.
He had not eaten since the morning, had walked several miles with a twisted leg, his clothes were drenched, and he had a halfpenny between himself and starvation. With all this, he could laugh over the loss of his razor. One could not help admiring him.